CityTalk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. CityTalk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talks Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the independent private sector lobby group and business networking club Downtown Liverpool in Business, and every Sunday we look at some of the week's big business stories and talk to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider northwest region.
You couldn't get any today, so you got me in
there. This week I'm talking football, fitness and finance. I attended a dinner on Tuesday and heard the Bank of England governor express his concerns about the Eurozone. And even though inflation increased to over 5% this week, it's deflation that will be the problem next year. Can the UK weather the latest financial storms, or is it all out of our hands and in the lap of the gods, or at least in the lap of the Greeks? As health surveys show that many of us who are now in our 30s and 40s will live to the ripe old age of 100, how can we restructure our economy and indeed our lifestyles to cope? Can the country afford to pay pensions to all of us who are 65 and over in the future? And how can the health service survive? A fat tax, anyone? And why is our beautiful game seemingly being governed by a bunch of Muppets? No sooner had the row died down about the so-called bigger clubs wanting more cash for TV rights than along comes a proposal to scrap promotion and relegation. It's like the Monty Python crew are in charge of football in this country at the moment. To discuss this and more, if we have time, two guests join me in the studio. The managing director of Addy Consultancy, Bill Addy, and the quiet retiring, though not retired, Derek Hatton from Bike to Work. Good morning to you both.
Morning, Frank.
How are you, Frank?
I'm very well, thank you, and great to see you both in the studio today. Before I get into the body of the stuff I was talking to in the introduction there, very interesting report earlier this week that I know will be of interest to both of you. So Terry Leahy, supported by Michael Heseltine, calling for a greater Liverpool and an elected mayor for greater Liverpool, a Boris for our city region. Derek, as somebody who's been involved in politics and interested in politics in this city for many, many years, what's your view of that particular proposal?
I think it's interesting, this whole thing about Greater Liverpool, and I probably, when you look back with hindsight, you can look at things that you would have done in a different way. And there's not many that I'd have done in a different way. But one of the few things that I would have changed is we'd have really campaigned for Merseyside to be Greater Liverpool, because at the time that the Old Merseyside County Council went, I suppose that would have been a time where we could have actually done put some pressure on. Because when you look at Manchester, the way that that suddenly became Greater Manchester, and all of a sudden overnight became a massive, massive operation, whereas before you had, you know, the Manchesters, the Boltons, the Berries and all the rest of it. Even though you still got them, you've now got a conglomerate which exerts power, influence, also gives an impression as far as the economy is concerned that it's much bigger than it is. We don't do that. We have Liverpool, we have Sefton, we have infighting, places like Southport say they should or shouldn't be, we've had over the years. You have all the nonsense. Then you have, you know, the nonsense lot at Everton saying we'd keep Everton in the city because it's going to Kirby, as though some of people in Kirby are not Scousers. You know, all this nonsense has happened because we haven't been prepared to say we are Greater Liverpool. Now, OK, it's only a name, but I think in that name it says an awful lot. And I think that was something that perhaps we should have campaigned a lot harder on in the 80s about going for Greater Liverpool rather than Merseyside.
And Bill, you know, from a business perspective, you're involved a lot with property. I know that you're having to deal with planners from all over the country, but in Liverpool as well. Do you think that the elected mayor, that sort of leadership where you've got clear direction and somebody who is individually responsible and accountable for decision-making processes would actually help?
Yeah, Frank, it's interesting, isn't it, when you read that report that Sir Terry and in fact Michael Heseltine co-wrote. They're calling for not just the Greater Liverpool, as Derek said there, but also they're calling for leadership and vision. And that leadership needs to be a concerted and a cohesive leadership, leading the one Greater Liverpool region. And I think that it's interesting that this is the first time it's actually somebody of that level has come out and said quite clearly. I mean, it's Terry is a Liverpool guy, but he led an international business. And it's interesting that he talks about the fact that we do need that leadership, and that leadership coming from an elected mayor that the people of the greater Liverpool region can vote for.
I think the irony, though, is when you think about it, that the reason why we're actually having to have this discussion is because really in the wake of what happened in Liverpool and in Lambeth and a number of other authorities in the 80s, all of a sudden, like a knee-jerk reaction, that the consecutive Tory and Labour governments have seen it fit to take more and more powers off local authorities. Mm. And had it been the case as it was at the beginning of the 80s, where the local authority had powers, you wouldn't need a mayor then.
No.
Because we didn't need a mayor, we just take decisions anyway. Yeah. But the reason why you need one now is because successive governments have taken powers away from local authorities. Well, and that's the unfortunate thing.
Do you think the other point of this, though, and I think Heseltine has been a big advocate of elected mayors for many years now, so I think there's two important aspects to this. Firstly, I think they've grasped the nettle in terms of the city region-wide powers that you would need if the mayor is actually to assert the powers and influence that he or she would require. But the second point, Eric, is that actually over the years, if you look at the interest or lack of in local government in comparison to, say, London or in comparison to Scotland, where they've got their own parliament now, never mind their own mayors, then actually there is a case to be made that suggests that if you've got personalities and, as I say, leaders who the local community can identify with, so your Boris Johnsons, your Ken Livingstons, whether you love them or loathe them, everybody knows the buck stops with them. And I think part of the problem with local government now is that you don't have those big personalities.
Yeah, but personalities, Frank, come from power. No personality in their right mind is going to put themselves up for a position within local government when they know it's a toothless tiger, when they know they haven't got powers. Officers have got more powers than elected members these days. So why on earth would a personality... We got involved in the 80s because we knew we could make a difference. We could build houses, we could build sports centres, we could create... We could do what we liked those. OK, at the end of the day, the government turned around, House of Lords turned around and says you can't do it anymore. But nonetheless, we'd already done an awful lot. We had the powers to do it. Whereas and that produces characters, it produces individuals, it produces people who are committed. You don't get that commitment, you don't get the people, you don't get the personality, because they know that what can they do when they go there? There's nothing for them to do. And by the way, the same argument could be applied to a mayor, because I saw some stuff you showed me, Frank, a couple of years ago, what were the powers of the mayor. I mean, quite honestly, he was a toothless tiger. You can have all the elected mayors you like, but unless that elected mayor's got powers, it's pointless having him.
Well, that's what Heseltine has shifted the goalpost, Bill, hasn't he, with this?
Exactly,
because
right.
He's saying that if you go into... have elected mayors in provincial cities, so Birmingham, Liverpool, Manchester and so on, it has to be, first of all, significant in terms of the geographical area, but secondly, and more importantly, similar powers to the London mayor.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you need to have that independence and authority, but you need to have that particular the weight behind it. As he's saying in the report, there's over 2 million people in the greater Liverpool region. So, in fact, we should get away from calling it the greater Liverpool. We don't need to see that. Liverpool is a great brand. I travelled across America this year, and everywhere I went, you tell people where you come from. As soon as you say Liverpool, they instantly recognise it. If you mention Merseyside, they don't. So Liverpool doesn't need to be called greater Liverpool. It just needs to be called Liverpool. And I'm sure that the other local authorities would see the benefits they could get by being a sub-brand underneath the Liverpool brand. Well, it's not about Liverpool, sorry, Frank, taking over control and assuming that the key directions and decision-making, but it's about Liverpool using its historical prominence.
I mean, the irony of this, of course, and Derek mentioned it, is that it's basically recreating the powers that existed under the old Merseyside County Council.
Yes.
The only difference, actually, is that you would have an individual that was an elected mayor. And, you know, we can argue all day, I suppose, about whether or not that's a positive move or not. The other thing I would make
I would say, though, Frank,
reference
just
to
leave that one.
Just go on to the point you made earlier, though, about Manchester. Now, you know, you were saying rightly that local government has been robbed of an awful lot of powers. But if you look at the way Manchester's handled that, and that greater Manchester, and the volume of organisations, councils, people involved, and Bernstein and Leash leading that, they've still got significant influence, Derek. And I think what's happened is they've reacted perhaps more nimbly to the changes than Liverpool has.
Yeah, they have. There's no question about that. But just to go back, we'll come to that, Frank, but go back to what you said before about the old Merseyside County Council, about needing a mayor there. The reality is that when Kiva Coombs was leader of the Merseyside County Council that all those many, many decades ago. I didn't agree with everything Kiva did, but the one thing about him is that he acted like a leader. And because of the powers that he had, he was virtually a mayor anyway. You didn't need to call him a mayor, because in those days, you didn't need to call me and John Hamilton mayors. The reality is, because you had the powers, you could be yeah. do that job anyway. And the only reason why now you need the name mayor is because someone needs to come along and take away those powers from the government and from the officers, and perhaps the mayors to do it. But don't let's kid ourselves that just the creation of a mayor will do it. You correctly mentioned, gave the analogy of Manchester. It hasn't been the creation of somebody in Manchester that's actually made the difference. The reality in Manchester is that business leaders and local authority leaders have come together and said, hang on a minute, we are going to carry on here and make sure that we have some sort of movement going forward involving anybody else, and we're going to be proud of the region. Yeah. And you didn't get people in the Boltons and the Berries and everything else saying, we don't want to be part of Manchester. Mm. They weren't given a choice. They said, hang on, we're all going to be in this together. And by doing that, business came in, the economy thrived, jobs were created, everything started moving there. Yeah. And in Liverpool, we started having this silly infighting going on. And when we got the powers taken, for decades, there was just no one in the local authority that was prepared to take a decision about anything. Yeah. And for that reason, we saw the problems that we saw. Luckily, now it's beginning to change, where businesses begin to thrive. We've got a good local authority, a good council leader who's prepared to take a stand, and you're beginning to see a bit of a difference now.
I was going to say, Bill, we have seen a difference, haven't we, since Joe Anderson made the decision to become a full-time leader.
Yes.
But I think Joe, and he's on the show in a few weeks' time, so I'm sure we'll discuss this, but I think Joe
would
be
Muslim
the first...
Frank, you know that,
of course he did. Of course he did. But I think Joe would be the first to admit that one of the frustrations that any Liverpool City Council leader would have is having to deal with your Knowsleys, your Seftons, your Wirrells, who have got exactly the same powers as he has at the moment.
Yes, that's right. I mean, what you've got is you've got a large city region which is split down into subdivisions, and the leadership within that are possibly can be seen as fighting against each other. I mean, not in the way that they're all driving towards trying to get their own particular economy moving. They're all trying to get their own particular local areas getting priority. And what we need is a concerted response to what's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, as you said, we have got some positive steps moving forward, but it's... against the difficulties that the local councils are having. Obviously, we know about the £91 million worth of cuts. These years' cuts are going to be even worse, aren't they?
Well, you're absolutely right, Bill. And when you think that we've got six chief executives, you know, six council leaders, Lord knows how many councillors running around, most of whom nobody's ever heard of.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, you can be lucky that you haven't, because I've met a lot of them. And, you know, it's just a nonsense
that we're
spending so much money on bureaucracy. At that level.
And what you've left out there, Frank, is the thousands and thousands of officers who are doing one thing in Liverpool, one thing in Sefton, one thing in St Helens, one thing in Knowsley, one thing in Wirral, where very often, you know, one officer there instead of six could be doing it for the whole area. Because let's be honest, it doesn't matter how big the area is, the job's still the same.
Yeah. And then you've got, you know, cuts in areas where you actually do need people.
Exactly.
You need staff in social services and education and so on and so forth. Just one final point on this then, because everybody out there will be asking the question, if we had an elected mayor, who would it be? Bill?
Well, now, that's a question, isn't it, Frank? Who would that be? Well, you know, everybody's going to put it... I'd actually love to see Derek coming back. Well, that'd be an interesting one, but I don't think he'd do the job now.
Certainly would. Every time it comes up, all the media always ring up and say, would you do it? But I say, no, I'd be Frank's agent.
You'd be my agent. Well, you'd be my agent and I'd be Joe Anderson's agent, so that'd be quite an interesting campaign. The great thing is, I think, though, there would be interest in it.
I think, with
those powers, and you're absolutely right, Derek, I think the job at the moment is a very, very, very difficult one, must be, as I say, a very frustrating.
But also, Frank, it does come back just quickly to what we said before. It's not about the person. Well, it is about the person, but it's about the powers they will have. Yeah. And quite honestly, it doesn't matter whether it's you, me, Joe Anderson, Bill, Fred Bloggs, or whoever. If there are no powers there, it's a waste of time. And it's all about the powers.
But just finishing on that, Derek, it is the powers, but it's also one region being able to respond to central government, where we've got central government impacting on the local regions in the cuts they're imposing.
Okay,
and that's
what
we need to do.
We've come to the end of the first part of the programme. Very lively start to the show. Join us after the break when I'll be looking at the Bank of England governor's comments that he made at St George's Hall on Tuesday evening. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined in the studio this week by Bill Addy from Addy Consultancy, a property consultancy management group, and by Derek Hatton from Bike to Work. And before the break, we've been talking about Greater Liverpool elected mayors. Earlier this week, I was at a dinner Tuesday evening at St George's Hall. The Bank of England Governor, Mervyn King, was telling us that actually there's a limited amount to what the UK government can do, because if the Eurozone collapses, then it'll have a huge impact on the UK economy and we will be in deep, deep trouble. Equally, the other point that he made, which I found quite interesting, was that they're not concerned in the least about interest rates hitting 5% plus, because next year, things like the VAT increase, which went to 20%, the fuel prices and energy price increases, they will have then been taken into account for the first 12 months, and they will be concerned more about deflation, so going below 2%. But let me come back to the main crux of his analysis, which was, doesn't really matter that George Osborne is going around making the cuts that he's making and setting the economy straight from their perspective. If Germany, Greece, Italy, Spain, Portugal, Ireland and so on get it wrong, then actually there's nothing to have for us anyway.
I think for him to say it doesn't matter, it certainly does matter to those people who are getting their bleeding jobs cut. You know, let's be honest, I mean, you can't be sitting here and thinking to yourself, hang on a minute, you know, oh, it's just an academic exercise. The fact of the matter is people are going to lose their jobs and they are going to lose their, you know, very, very vital services because of what he said. But I think the other point is actually quite fascinating. I've been thinking about this for a while. I mean, you've got a position here where for years and years and years, the Osbournes and the Hagues of the world have been saying how absolutely disastrous it would be for us to be part of the euro. It would be, where would we possibly, we couldn't possibly do that. In fact, what we should do is we should have a referendum when we come to government and we should move out of Europe completely. You know, first of all, they're running away from the idea of a referendum because they know it can't work. But secondly, the reality is that whether we like it or not, we've got the worst of all worlds. On the one hand, we haven't been part and parcel of the decision making and the leadership of the euro for all these years. Now we've got to sit back and allow all of Europe to make the decisions, and whatever decisions they make, we've got to say yes sir, no sir, three bags full sir. Mm. The reality is we should have joined the euro right at the beginning, which would at least have put us into a position where we had some say over the years and how it was going, and we would now be in a driving seat. Although having said that, having Osborne in a driving seat, maybe it's a good job we didn't. We'd be in the driving seat in terms of how Europe would go instead of being a backseat passenger like we are now.
Well, actually, somebody made the comment, I don't think it was Mervyn King, but somebody made the comment, we've got a place at the table but not a voice. Exactly. Which I thought was quite telling. But the other point that was made, and this is something that, you know, politically, if I was the Labour Party at the moment, I'd be jumping up and down about, was that for the last 5 or 6 years, the UK actually has had a very strong, stable economy. And even though we had to bail out the banks and we had that huge problem in 2008, the way in which Gordon Brown handled the crisis at the time gave the markets the confidence that the UK economy was stable. We kept our AAA rating. And the thing that Brown did that I haven't seen much evidence of from the coalition is that he actually was on planes and he was talking to European leaders, and he appeared at least to have the ear of the President of the United States, the President in Germany, France and so on. Seems to me that Cameron and co have almost sat back and said, well, over to you. And, you know, if Mervyn King's right, that's simply not good enough, because unless there's a coordinated response to what's happening out there, then actually, you know, we're not going to get out of this mess.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's as Derek says, isn't it? We are linked, we're outside of the euro, but we are linked to Europe. We are Europeans, we are linked to Europe. And as you say, at the moment we see Merkel and Sarkozy linking together France and Germany, obviously because of the impact that a Greek failure will have on the French and German banks. Mm. So we seem to see Merkel and Sarkozy acting in unison, but we don't seem to be doing anything about it. And really, we should be in there. And you go back to those pre the election, Gordon Brown, regardless of what his faults, he actually made some decisions and he was out, as you say, he was on the plane, he went over to Washington And in those days in 2008, when it was almost a catastrophic meltdown of the world's economy, he came up with some leadership, and that's what we're missing at the moment from the country. The coalition government aren't doing that. They see that there's just one option, isn't there, to just make the cuts. If you balance your budget, then everything will work out OK. But that's not the case, is it? Because you've got the impact of what your neighbour's doing.
And I'll tell you what, it makes a nonsense of some of the campaigning that goes on the far right of the Tory party, in the likes of UKIP, who, as Derek was saying, are campaigning to get out of Europe, when whether we were in or out, and we're only halfway in a sense now because of the decision that was taken over the euro, whatever the decision we take, we can't just be immune from the things that are happening over there. So it's absolute crackers, really, that people campaign on that basis. But if we do come back to home, and we look at a subject that I know is close to your heart, Derek, if you'll forgive the pun. Health surveys now showing that many of us in our 30s and 40s, that includes Bill and I, will live to the ripe old age of 100. You and I have had a serious discussion about this, because what it does mean is that, you know, economically again, the impact that then has on pensions, on the health service, on the whole infrastructure of the UK. And I know you spoke at a Medicash conference earlier this week, Fit for Business, which was looking at how companies could start to influence some of that agenda and help people perhaps change the way in which they eat, in which the way they live, keep fit and so on and so forth. And, of course, the introduction of a fat tax is even being discussed. So, Derek, you're back to work, hat on now, and this subject that I know you're very passionate about.
Let's be honest. I mean, obesity is not a disease. It's a disgrace, you know, and I don't want to hear all this nonsense about, oh, poor people over there. I mean, OK, there are the odd person who is very fat for medical reasons, and I apologise to you if you're listening for being like that, but I'm sorry, you're in the very small minority. The rest of you are fat. You're fat because for two reasons, because you eat too much and you don't walk enough. That's the reality. Let's not kid ourselves. You're going to die of a heart attack more likely than anybody else. You're going to get cancer more likely than anybody else. You're certainly going to get diabetes more than anybody else. That is a fact. But not only are you going to be, it's going to be bad for you, it's going to be bad for us, thank you very much, as well. Something like £13 billion is being lost in lost production because of the results of people being obese. That's what's happening. It's costing £4.7 billion to the National Health Service because you're obese and everything that goes with it. That's the reality. And everybody listening to this show this morning who is 40 and under can look round at their peers and think that one out of every 20 is going to reach the age of 100. One out of every 20 is going to reach the age of 100. And that doesn't mean that when you get to 100, you're fit up until you're fit to 100 and then suddenly die. And what that means is that over the decades, you will get more and more ill unless you do something about it. And the fatter you are, the more obese you are, the less fit and healthy you're going to be. And the more it's going to give you a problem, and the more you're going to be just simply repaired if you're lucky. The reality is it's going to give everyone a problem. And, you know, all this nonsense about, you know, oh, well, we might increase the pension age by 6 months here or a year there. I'm sorry, you're all going to be working for a lot, lot longer. Don't even look at 65 or 70. It's going to be longer than that. And the trade union, you know, about, we're campaigning for this. I'm sorry, you're all putting your head in the sand. You're all going to have to work a lot longer in order to ensure that there's money around for everybody, for everybody there. And the National Health Service is going to fall apart because of it. So at this stage, people have got to see not only the responsibility themselves, but to the responsibility of everybody else, and start now getting a lot fitter and a lot healthier. Otherwise, it's just going to be a... Talking about, you'd mentioned the word meltdown. It's going to be, it's got to be a meltdown of all that fat on people. Otherwise, it's not going to work.
I always love the way Derek sits on the fence. Bill, do you...
I was just going to say that, Frank. I mean, Derek, that's really sort of... You would say he's an evangelist for that, aren't you? Which is great. Well, seeing it, how... Such an example, if anybody's seen him in the flesh recently... He has obviously put his money where his mouth is.
He doesn't look bad for 80. No. Do you know that the serious point about this is, Derek's talking at a conference earlier this week to businesses. Do businesses, or should businesses do more in terms of helping, supporting, encouraging the staff to actually get involved in fitness regimes? Is there anything that businesses can do? Is it actually an individual choice and there's not much influence?
Well, it's both, isn't it? At the end of the day, it is an individual choice whether you sit on the couch and watch the telly or whether you get up and go out for a walk whether you go to the chip shop or whether you go to the greengrocers. That's an individual choice, but people should be encouraged. It's going back to, with the anti-smoking campaigns and the cutting out of smoking, and people in the workplaces did a lot to help against that and providing workplace programs for people who wanted to give up smoking. So again, it's important that the workplaces do provide provide guidance on diet, provide opportunities for people. I remember back 20 odd years ago when I used to work for a company that was based in North Wales, we had a visionary chairman who put a porter cabin next door to our office and brought a fitness instructor in. And at lunchtime, instead of going to the local sandwich shop, we'd go in to see the fitness instructor who'd take us out for a run around the North Wales Hills, which is great. I did actually, Derek, in those days. It was 20 years ago when I used to run marathons. But that was visionary in those days. But there are other companies that do the same, and companies do need to encourage their workers to be healthy.
Yeah.
And also, you mentioned that I'm part of Bike to Work, and you know that's only one of a number of companies that does this sort of thing. But you know, the whole question of getting on your bike and going and riding to work makes so much sense these days. You know, it's cheaper, it's healthier, it makes you feel better to start the day. I mean, it's quicker. Yeah. I mean, we've been going a couple of years now. You know, and we speak often to employers that we're selling. I mean, you know, how many bikes? I mean, something like 5,000 bikes in 2 years we've sold nationally. Now, for those all those employers have been talked to many times by our staff, and they say the difference in the people that actually are cycling to work compared to the rest, there's no comparison. They come in, they look forward to work much more. They're much sure they've done their bit, so they're really buzzing when they come in. You know, and the reality is they can get bikes for half price. You know, people can get a bike that's 500 for 250 quid, they can get it half price, and you know, it's a win-win-win-win situation. No one loses in it, and there's no logic in not doing it. If you're in a position where you go to the same place every day you work, there's no sense in not going on a bike.
And I think that whole agenda anyway around employee benefits, which fits into the health agenda, is something that we all need to be exploring, because, you know, again, if you go back to what the Bank of England was saying earlier this week, the chances are that whether you're in the public or the private sector, your wages ain't going up anytime soon. So what, you know, people have got to do, businesses have got to start to look at other incentives in which to reward the staff, and employee benefits is the way in which you can actually do that. And there are some tax advantages as well.
There are,
bike scheme, for example, there are subsidies around, aren't there?
Well, the employee doesn't pay tax or VAT at the moment. The employer doesn't pay national insurance. So the employer saves about 14%. In NI, apart from what the employee saves, you know, and it can be applied to car parking spaces, it can apply to nursing places, it can apply to phones, it can apply to lots of things, health checks.
Yes,
you know, it's crazy that we're not doing more of that.
Yeah, and I think there's an education process to go through there, isn't there? Because it is a relatively new agenda. I mean, you were saying, Bill, 20 years ago someone was doing it, but the few and far between the companies that are involved in this sort of stuff.
Well, that's right. I mean, there is few and far between. I mean, companies really are looking at their bottom line more and more, aren't they? And so they think that adding on some of these, these woolly sort of employee benefits don't actually add anything to the bottom line. But if you think about it, as Derek alluded to there, they do add to the bottom line, because most important thing is they give you healthy staff. And they also make staff feel that they're wanted. And there are all the issues around about, as you said, now pay isn't being increased, but benefits can be, and people can feel wanted by the things that can be offered that don't cost a lot of money, but most importantly give you a healthy staff who actually think that they are worth something.
Yeah, and the statistics surrounding people off work sick over the last 12 to 18 months are frightening, actually. So anything that improves that improves productivity. So it's a win-win situation. And if you need any further information about the employee benefits packages that are available, then you can contact us at Downtown Liverpool and we will point you in the right direction. Listen, we've come to the second part, end of the second part of the programme, and we're heading into the last lap onto the back pages. And so it's appropriate that after the break, we'll be talking sport, we'll be talking all things football. And for a change, I'm in the studio this week with two fabulous fellow Evertonians. Stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
And welcome back to the programme. I'm in the studio this week with Bill Addy and Derek Hatton. And we're going to turn our attention to football, or at least the business of football, and all sorts of weird and wonderful ideas floating about at the moment. Some of the so-called bigger clubs, Liverpool in particular, suggesting that they should have more cash from TV rights.
You mean bigger clubs and Liverpool?
And Liverpool, because of their popularity abroad. And then this week, along came a suggestion that we should scrap promotion and relegation because, of course, any of the poor 20 clubs in the Premier League shouldn't have to go through the financial trauma that success or lack of success would cause them. What's happening to our beautiful game, chaps? Because, you know, the three of us are OK. You know, we'll declare an interest to an extent. We're all staunch Evertonians. But it wasn't so long ago, and it might happen again if our financial situation doesn't improve pretty smartish. You know, we were in relegation battles, and I'd have hated anybody to come along at that time and say, well, we're going to scrap relegation this year because, you know, it's just totally anti-competitive, and it takes some of the excitement away. The season would be over.
On that day against Wimbledon, I think if someone had said that, he'd have bitten their hand off.
I was just about to say that, Derek. I remember the Coventry game, and I suppose it was some of the greatest exciting moments we had at Goodison in the 90s, wasn't it? I mean,
but you get the point. You know, if you take away relegation and promotion, which is not a new thing, by the way. This has been floating around for a long time. And the more foreign ownership you get in the Premier League, and the more Americans and Indians and so on. In fact, the Blackburn owners, you know, last season only realised, allegedly, with about six games to go, that they could get relegated.
Yeah, I understood that. They asked the question, what is this relegation?
Mm. But, you know, where's it going? Where's it all going to end?
Well, you can see where it would end, wouldn't you? I mean, we're not talking about football anymore. We're talking about a business. And for us who are passionate, who are football supporters, then football should be the most important thing. And I think it's to talk about removing relegation from a Premier League, what you do then, you cut off. What do you say to the likes of the teams that have just been relegated and you can never come back up again? What about the ambition of the chairman that wants to get his club back in? What about the Queen's Park Rangers? Look where they've come into the Premier League this year.
You see, the problem you've got here is that the moment you got television involved in the way you do, particularly Sky, and we all love the way Sky can do football. Yeah. I mean, we hate Sky for all sorts of other reasons. We hate News International. You know, we hate The Sun. We hate Kelvin McKenzie after the Hillsborough thing, you know. I mean, nobody should ever in Liverpool buy The Sun ever again. But we all actually turn around and we watch Sky because we like football. But once that started off, that really it was the slippery slope.
Yeah.
From then on in, you knew you were going to have big wages. There was going to be big money involved. You're be in a position where that anybody who didn't have the money was going to lose out, and the control would go even further away from supporters and even local owners, and that's what's happened. And you've got a position now where, you know, the whatever happens in football really can't be agreed upon unless the TV agree. Because the TV decide when the schedule is, they decide what the timetables are, they decide, you know, what time the referee blows his whistle.
Well, exactly,
they decide,
you sit at the ground and you wait for the referee to blow his whistle because he's waiting for a signal from the sidelines.
I mean, that's the sort of control they have. So when you talk about, you know, relegation or not, when you talk about, you know, what Liverpool were talking about a match a couple of weeks ago over their television rights, it's all about money now. It's all about what money they can make. Whether it's individual clubs, whether it's clubs generally, or whether it's players as well. And the players, we've got to remember that the players and agents have got an awful lot to answer for in terms of the way they've behaved. And, you know, we can sit here and say it's not right. And I'm sorry, it's almost, and listen, I never give up on any fight, but it's one of those fights at the moment. You've got to accept that it's almost out of our control totally. It's in the hands of the television more than anybody, and they'll decide what happens. And if they say it's going to, and they say, oh, well, hang on, all the clubs wouldn't agree with him. Sorry, if the money was right, clubs would agree with it.
They would do, that's right. I mean, if the Premier League were voting now on no relegation, then it would be a straightforward vote, wouldn't it? I can't see any of the current Premier League clubs saying, oh, no, we think you should stick with relegation. Because they're in it, they're in the club, then, aren't they? They're safe.
I think the problem I would see would be for the longer term and the sustainability of the game if that ever happened. Because I do think that despite the fact that we've got huge amounts of money now, you know, there are still, let's say, four or five teams who could potentially challenge for the Premiership this season. Realistically, probably three. I don't think even back in the 80s, the 70s, there were ever more than three or four that could challenge for it. And occasionally you get a Derby County or a Nottingham Forest coming through. But if you were to say you don't have relegation, then actually, for an awful lot of clubs, the season would be over by September.
Yeah.
Because the only thing that they play for, and, you know, if you talk to clubs who, you know, have been involved in that sort of relegation battle season on season. I was talking to about Munra's supporter earlier this week, and he was saying to me, he actually found it more exciting when they were doing that yo-yo period under Allardyce. You know, they'd come off for a couple of seasons and they'd be battling, and then they'd go down, they'd have the playoffs and all that excitement. He said, now this mid-table stuff that they've had over the last few years, bit boring, really. And it's okay for the television channels to get as much cash as they can at the moment. And I have to say, arguably, it's okay for some of the owners at the moment as well, because in 10 years' time, they won't be here. But for the game's long-term future, you wonder why the governing body in this country, the FA, and Derek, you were talking about toothless organisations and toothless councils earlier. Is there any more toothless an organisation than the FA? Because I just think they just stand back and allow anything that what you would describe as television, business, whatever you want to call it, they just come in and dictate things that are clearly not in the long-term interest of the game.
Well, the FA is what you've said, is a toothless organisation. It's really much, it's a gentleman's club, isn't it, really, that is ineffectual. If we look at the way that they control the England setup, that we get an Italian manager coming in. OK, you could argue there's no real English manager capable of doing that. But to the average football fan, to be honest, Premier League fans, I'm sure that very few of us actually are that interested in what England do on the pitch.
Well, you just got to look at the way they behaved. You're right, the English said, look at the way they behaved over decades, over the football managers, the England managers. You know, they would have the respectable gentleman. Anyone's got any side of them has got a bit of character or a bit of something out of, you know, look, wouldn't have Brian Clough, look at Terry Venables, even wouldn't have Howard Kendall because he's a bit of a character. Loads of people that were absolutely brilliant managers, and they wouldn't have them because they were characters. They just wanted, you know, little do-gooders because that was the type of play. Type of setup they were, and in many ways it hasn't changed now. That's the way they still are, and the problem you've got is that because they are toothless, because they've got no real power or influence, that does attract people who just pontificate over their navel all day because they've got nothing else to do. They've got no real power. So it's what we were saying about local authorities. Organisations that have no power actually produce the most boring individuals going. And just as local authorities have done that over the last two or three decades, politics has done it over the last two or three decades, football has done it as well, you know. And that's where you get no one really with any excitement going involved in the FA. And if they do, I mean, well, Brian Barwick, who apart from being a dirty red, is a cracking fella, you know, who did go in the FA and wanted to change, all of a sudden he realised he couldn't and he had to get out. And that happens so many times.
And you're right, and if you look at, and we'll just stick with this subject of personalities, actually, because I'm quite interested in that. You're talking about local politics, and we're talking about the FA, and we're talking about all sorts of different organisations, lack of leadership, lack of personalities. I went in down to the Commons not so long ago, and I was looking across the benches, and I was comparing the characters that you sit there, and I didn't know half of them, I have to say. And I was comparing what we've got in the Commons now, and I'm not being party political here because I'm talking about all of them, in comparison to what we had, and again, whether you love them or you loathe them, in terms of the characters and personalities that you had through the 80s and some of the big personalities and politicians that you had say in Blair's first cabinet. So do you think, just generally speaking, politics, never mind, forget the politics of football, politics, and forget local government, is actually struggling to get the calibre of person interested in leading the country or becoming a member of parliament? Is it just becoming too much hassle?
Exactly. It's not just that. Who wants to do it when they haven't got any powers? I mean, we said before about local authorities, there's no power there. MPs have got no power. You go as an MP now, unless you actually toe the line totally, you don't get anywhere near any cabinet position. And when you get a cabinet position, collective responsibility comes in and you've got to do as you're told. Nobody really, you know, takes a line on anything serious now and as they go, and it just doesn't happen at all, you know. And you're right. I mean, in the 80s, both sides, at least there were opinions. I mean, there was a divided parliament. There was people on the right and people on the left who had very, very strong opinions, and there were characters doing it, and you knew what you were voting for, and you knew there was a difference, you know. And, you know, I'm sorry, Frank, you mentioned Blair's first cabinet. I mean, that was the first cabinet that made sure there was just going to be boring mediocrity. That was the first cabinet that paved the way there wasn't any differences. He made sure that he controlled that cabinet in such a way that from then on in, nobody took a stand.
And what we have now, we have almost a vanilla in terms of politicians. You've got three leaders. Well, are they leaders? Because they all look the same to me. They all almost sound the same.
Yeah.
And but then you ask the question, do we actually get the politicians we deserve as a population? Because how many people voted in the general election? And people don't vote in the general election because they're apathetic towards it, because really politicians don't have a great impact on their daily lives, or don't appear to, when in fact they do. But we suffer from the fact that we vote in the people who are the least able to lead us as a nation.
I think that's a great point, actually, because and I don't think it's just because a lot of people decide not to bother voting. I think the scrutiny that politicians now come under has gone beyond what is reasonable. Yeah. And I think that anybody who's got more than half a brain and got a bit of ability and thinks, well, how am I going to get on? How am I actually going to influence what happens in my local community, or indeed, you know, the wider world? There are other ways of doing it than politics now.
Well, there
and
are.
You can do it without actually worrying about being on the front page. I was going to say the News of the World then. Sad that's not here then.
But you have to look at some...
That's one of the better things that's happened this year.
But you look at... Sorry, Frank, to cut across here. But you look at politicians now, and why are they in politics? The vast majority in there, because it's a career and because they see a career structure going forward. And it's not about serving the population. It's not about serving the electorate. It's about serving themselves in a lot of ways.
I got an email a few years ago. I get emails often from people who are students who are studying politics, and they want to sort of look at what's happened in the 80s, or they want to look at this, that and the other. I got an email a few years ago from a student in Oxford who was doing politics, and his words were, "I know for a fact that I want a career in politics, but I'm not sure which party to join yet."
I just
looked at that and laughed. And
was
I said,
it from
what?
Nick Clegg? Hey? Was it from Nick Clegg?
No, yeah. You just looked at that and you think, that says it all now.
That's right.
You're right, Bill. Yeah. People just want a career in it and have to think, hang on, where's the best career path for me? Where will I fit in best? Who do I know more people, you know? Yeah. And it's nothing to do with... On some sides, it was about principles and about beliefs. And on both sides, you know, I'm not talking about being party political.
Back into the 80s, wasn't it?
We all got involved, and the Tories all got involved because they had beliefs and passions, and they became, as a result of those beliefs and passions, got to where they were, you know. Yeah. And as a result of that, you got, you know, we're talking about the elections. I mean, we used to get 60% voting for us in local elections. 60% turnout in local elections. Okay, a lot came to vote against and for, but nonetheless, at least the interest was there. You know, 60% in the local election, where you're getting sometimes now 8% or
something. You get more voters on X Factor, don't you, than you do for the actual election.
Maybe not this year, but just to end on a positive note for our MPs, and we're talking about passion, I haven't seen many more passionate speeches than the one Steve Rotherham gave this week.
Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant.
I think
we should go on record saying him and Andy Burnham were absolutely out of this world. I mean, I got in the middle of Steve Rotherham's speech and switched it on. Yeah. And I watched BBC Parliament. How sad am I? I watched BBC Parliament for 4.5 hours. Mm-hmm. Except there was a half an hour Inside Out was on on Hillsborough as well. And I switched over to that. But apart from that, I watched it for the whole time. And I'll tell you what, it was just an amazing experience. It was one of those things that you know, you're glad you watched it and you're glad you saw it. Yeah. You almost felt part of it, even though you weren't. And as you say, Steve Rotherham was absolutely superb.
That's right.
But then again, do you notice now the establishments are starting to that pot weight or whatever he was, that letter yesterday, he'd involved in the Bradford thing, already saying it's about time Liverpool families drew a line and got on with it. You
outrageous.
Can see, oh,
outrageous.
Unbelievable.
I mean, at last, it seems that there might be some light at the end of the tunnel. Mm. But I won't be absolutely convinced until we've seen all the papers, they've been scrutinised, and we actually get the truth.
Yes.
And the sad thing is, you know, the people who actually should be standing up and apologising are long gone now.
Right. Well, I want to know what role Thatcher played in it, because I'll tell you what, there's no question about it, she played a part in that.
Yeah, you quite liked her, didn't you? Got on quite well with her when you were in your political days. Anyway, we've sadly run out of time, and I'm afraid we've come to the end of another Downtown Liverpool in Business with me, Frank McKenna. Thanks to my guests this week, Bill and Derek. Derek, you're off to Fulham now to see the Mighty Blues hopefully win 3 points. Thanks most of all for you for listening. Have a great week and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in Business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. Listen and log on to great music and great conversation on City Talk 105.9.